Well, my first message really goes out to our South Sudanese humanitarian workers, and to recognize that while we often talk about the international humanitarian response in South Sudan, that the vast majority of people carrying out this humanitarian response are actually South Sudanese nationals. They're also the ones that are often in the front line. And unfortunately, when we see attacks on humanitarian workers happening, they are often the ones that pay with their lives. So this year alone, we lost three humanitarian workers, all South Sudanese nationals in the line of duty. And my second message, and I don't know whether these people listen to the radio, but it's really towards, we've seen in the past period looting of, for example, WFP trucks, these type of things. Just to emphasize that when food gets stolen from WFP, it's not actually WFP that is the main victim. It's the communities where the food would be going to. So it's really a call, on the one hand, for the authorities to continue to step up their efforts, which they have been doing, to ensure security for humanitarian workers, but also for the communities themselves to help with providing that security. Because, again, if something gets stolen from a humanitarian organization, the first victims are those, the poorest of the poor in South Sudan, who are relying on this humanitarian assistance to survive.
And talking about insecurity, South Sudan is one of the countries that tops the lists when it comes to humanitarians working in very insecure environments, as well as losing their lives. And this is a day to highlight that. How can you speak into that? How does this affect humanitarian work when they are blocked from doing their job, but also they keep getting killed on the line of duty?
Well, I mean, beyond, of course, the first is the suffering that causes for the families of those that lose their lives in the line of duty, if I can say it like that. But secondly, of course, every time there is an incident in a certain area, that means that we either have to suspend or slow down the humanitarian assistance that communities and the people of South Sudan are waiting for. So there is a direct link between our ability to help people to survive and have a dignified life and this level of insecurity. The higher the insecurity, the more difficult it is for us to deliver. But also, and thirdly, and I think that's really important, I've said it a number of times already, we're in an environment where the funding for humanitarian assistance is going down quite rapidly. And insecurity increases the cost of delivery. So that means that with the same amount of money, we can deliver less humanitarian assistance if we have to take more precautions around protecting our humanitarian workers, around protecting the humanitarian goods. So there is a direct link between the cost of humanitarian service delivery and insecurity. And finally, I have to say, when when you look at it from the perspective of the capital of the countries that are providing assistance, having this type of statistic whereby South Sudan is seen as one of the most dangerous countries in the world to provide humanitarian assistance does not necessarily encourage those capital cities and the governments there to spend more money on humanitarian assistance in South Sudan, because they may say, like, well, you know, why, if we can deliver assistance in countries that are safe, or where humanitarian workers can do their job safely, put it like that, why should we go to South Sudan? So I think for all of these reasons, it is really critical that this is one of the statistics that hopefully in the next humanitarian day, we no longer have to say that South Sudan is one of the most dangerous countries to provide humanitarian assistance in.
Okay, we'll be talking about funding a bit later. I'll bring that back. But I want to still highlight on insecurity. Apart from the killings, WFP trucks were looted. In May, there were about 100 trucks. The result was there was a suspension for a bit. How have you been handling this insecurity? Do you always have to suspend and then reevaluate and then come back? How does this not only affect your work as humanitarians, but also the people who are in need of that particular aid?
Well, whether or not to suspend, I mean, suspension is a decision that humanitarian organizations don't take lightly. It's really sort of a measure of last resort, because we are aware that if we suspend, it's the people that are waiting for the food or any other assistance that we're talking about who are the prime victims. So this is really a decision that is taken based upon internal analysis of seeing is it possible to safely continue or not, because of course the safety of our staff is a paramount consideration in this type of decision. So, but if we do suspend, then you know, it can be that that the assistance is delayed, or sometimes that the assistance is not going to come and that we have to divert it to other parts of South Sudan, because it's not that there isn't a lack of that there isn't a shortage of people that are in need of humanitarian assistance. So it's really, suspension is the measure of last resort, but in this case and in other cases, we unfortunately have had to resort to that, because we were not comfortable. The security situation was not conducive for us to immediately continue our assistance. And of course, beyond the suspension, you know, if items get stolen, whether it's food or something else, it takes a while to replace those items, even if it's not necessarily a matter of money, because it might be covered by the insurers. But even in these type of situations, everything, to get anything into South Sudan takes quite a long time. It's not like you just go to the market and here we go, you have a couple of tons of food. That's not the way it works. So even if we don't suspend the activities, you will still slow down the delivery of aid, because it takes a while to replace what was stolen with new items. Just simply that's because of the logistics of South Sudan.
Okay, and that incident happened in Bor. How is the situation right now? Is the suspension lifted? What took place? It's been close to 3 months.
Well, the suspension has been lifted and the aid is continuing. But again, there are areas in you know, broader Jonglei that continue to provide quite significant security challenges for us to deliver. Now, I have to say that we have certainly had good support from the authorities to improve the situation. And some of the people that were involved in the Bor incident were arrested. And I think, you know, in ensuring accountability and making sure that these type of criminals are actually brought to justice and get punished for their crime, I think that's, it's a very important part of reducing the risk of this type of incidents. I also have to highlight the role that UNMISS and specifically the peacekeepers are playing, because also the peacekeepers are helping us to deliver humanitarian assistance in areas where without the peacekeepers we frankly wouldn't be able to operate because of the high levels of insecurity. So there are these positive collaborations. But as I said, I mean, I think going forward, the whole issue of accountability and ensuring that the people that engage, whether it's killing of humanitarian workers or whether it's harassing of humanitarian workers, whether it's stealing of humanitarian items, these people need to be prosecuted, and if they're found guilty, they need to be punished for their crime. And I think if we have more accountability, we will see slowly that these type of incidents are going down.
Have you experienced cases where government did actually come in and arrest these people and hold them accountable?
They did. I mean, for example, in the Bor situation, they arrested a number of people, and they're going through the, as far as I know, they're going through the process of the criminal, you know, the criminal trial process. So we are seeing, I think, an increased effort by the government to do that. Now, of course, again, we are operating in South Sudan, so in a country, the challenges faced by South Sudanese society in terms of weak government institutions, including relatively weak courts, weak police, I mean, there's no miracle solutions there either, because that it's not the institutions are not always there to respond in this way. I mean, the police is not always present, and it's there is an effort to improve that, but this institutional strengthening takes time, of course, and it's certainly going to be a challenge going forward, even with the political will of trying to ensure, which I believe is there, of trying to ensure accountability for this type of crimes.
These are issues you've been facing way before the Sudan crisis and the influx of returnees from different corners, different border points. We have the ones coming in from Sudan because of the Sudan crisis, but also in Uganda because of the ration cuts of food. South Sudanese are coming back home through Eastern Equatoria, through Central Equatoria. What is the outlook? What are your projections? And how is the humanitarian community planning to respond to this effectively?
Well, I mean, I think actually there is a third movement, and we still need to see how is it going to play out? But we also have returns from Ethiopia, from Gambela, where, although it looks like the last couple of days, the numbers have gone down a bit. In 5 days' time, we got about 1,000 people returning. Overall, there was a period where the numbers, we had a few days where the reported numbers were 3,000 to 4,000 people in one day arriving in South Sudan. So we will have to see, which has to do with tension in Gambela refugee camp in the surrounding area, and also with the suspension of food aid in Ethiopia following allegations of aid being diverted, and where the donors came together and decided to suspend the food aid. So looking forward towards the end of the year, you're looking at easily, if you take all, again, it's you know, I'm not, I don't have a crystal ball, but you're looking at maybe six, if you take all these movements together, maybe 700,000 people coming back to South Sudan. Now, not all of these people, of course, require humanitarian assistance, and we will focus only on those that are in need, just the way that we do inside South Sudan. There are some particular elements that are, in terms of our assistance, that are particular to these caseloads, and specifically with the returns from Sudan. A very important component is to support the transportation of the most vulnerable from the border points to their areas of destination, to avoid that in places like Ring we would have like 60, 70, 80, 90 or 100,000 people stuck there. Now, the issue is that, so what that means for us in terms of humanitarians is that the overall caseload of people in need of humanitarian assistance grows, because these are new, as I said, not all of them will need, but many of them, certainly many of them coming from Ethiopia and coming from Sudan, require humanitarian assistance. We were already struggling before the Sudan crisis to provide humanitarian assistance to the people inside South Sudan, because our humanitarian response plan is funded for about 43%, which means, for example, I'll give one example in the health sector, where we have only been able to reach 25% of the people that we should be reaching from a humanitarian perspective with health services. So that situation...
What period does this cover?
This year, the 2023.
Okay.
So this is an added challenge that we're facing, and we are... the international donors have been, I think, towards South Sudan extremely, I would say, really extremely generous in the past, since, let's say, since independence, and of course, even well before that as well. And still, they're providing significant funding to South Sudan, but that funding is going down, the needs are going up. And we are struggling with funding. I'll give an example. I mentioned transportation. If we're sort of week by week, we're sort of looking for some money to continue that transportation. Again, we're now potentially, if we don't get new money, then in 2-3 weeks' time, we will have to stop transportation, which would be a catastrophe for a place like Rink, because, and of course for the returnees themselves, because they would be stuck there. And so when you listen to donors, this is going to get worse next year in terms of the funding for a variety of reasons, which means that as humanitarians, we need to prioritize more. That means that we need to say, and it really comes down to that, saying like, okay, you community or person over there, we know that you are suffering and you are in a very vulnerable situation, but unfortunately we're not going to help you because there is a person over there, a community over there, that's even more vulnerable than you, and we'll be focusing on those because we don't have money to focus on both. So there's going to be hard decisions that will need to be made that are going to affect human life in South Sudan. There's no question about that. So and there is no medical solution. Sitting back, and I said it the other day in a forum where I was also with the government, sitting back in hoping that miraculously there's going to be more international funding is not an option, because that's not going to happen for 2024. So there's only two things. The first thing is that I believe that the national government will need to continue to increase its investment in basic services, because some of those basic services that currently are being provided by the humanitarian assistance, we will not be able, humanitarian actors, sorry.
What basic services are these?
Education, health, maybe in some areas, and nutrition and food. People are depending for their water and sanitation. People are depending for their survival on humanitarians, and that in some of the areas in the country, we will not be able to continue doing that. So, part of the solution is that the national government and of course the other level of governments need to step in where we will be pulling out. Secondly, of course,
are there some specific areas or locations or priorities that you have put in place already?
We are in the process of doing so, but in terms of geographical areas, no. But in terms of the type of assistance that is a priority, we had that discussion in the context of the Sudan returnees. So what is our priority? Priority is obviously food and nutrition. If people are starving, then any other services are superfluous. Then water and sanitation. Why is water and sanitation so important? If people don't have access to clean water, they will get ill, and they will, we will need to increase the health services for which we may not have money. And then, of course, finally, there is the health services, and these are sort of the core services that we need to. And then for the returnees, as I mentioned, transportation. So these are the core services that we will be focusing on. And then within those, we need to focus on the most vulnerable. There is, when you look at how it's decided where to provide food, for example, there's something called an IPC categorization. Now, in principle, when a community is in IPC 3, we don't need to go into the details what that means, but you should provide aid. Now, WFP has had to decide, we're not going to do that because we're going to focus on communities that are in IPC 4 and IPC 5, which are communities that are in even worse circumstances, while of course, WFP knows that we should provide aid in IPC3, because if we don't, the risk is that they backslide to IPC4. But this is one of these concrete decisions where WFP has had to say, okay, listen, this is what we have, so we're focusing on that. And I think that is going to continue and getting, and so that's why I think it's important for the national government to step in. And then, of course, secondly, the second solution to this is an acceleration of economic development, whereby peace is obviously an absolute priority for that, but whereby people are given the tools and the environment is created so that people can take care of themselves, because that's where, that's what people want, and that is where we need to go to. So there is no, and the problem is going to be the time frame of all of this, because these are that's going to be the issue, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So my sense is going to be that that there's going to be a lot of pressure on the poorest of the poor in South Sudan for the coming months and the coming year for sure, especially if the Sudan conflict continues and we continue to see pressure on prices. So I think we're in for a difficult period. And if I can bring it back as a final point to what we talked about earlier, to insecurity. Now, our concern is that when there are more people in need and we are not able to fill that need, that we're going to see an increased amount of attacks on attempts to steal things like food, non-food items, because people will get more desperate. So the risk is that if you cannot provide aid to communities, that then communities might, the insecurity towards our humanitarian assistance may well increase. We hope that that will not be the case, but we are very conscious of that risk, of course.
Do you have a plan to create some kind of awareness to reduce possibly this harsh response to the pullout? Is there a plan to pull out in a very strategic way?
Well, I mean, we're not at that point as yet where we have decided or this is where we're going to pull out. But we are, of course, discussing. We are having a series of strategic discussions inside the humanitarian community, and we'll also, of course, with the government, in terms of this prioritizing where and how will we be prioritizing. And part of that there will have to be a communication strategy around that, and that's something that we are working on. I said, it's not that tomorrow suddenly we are going to pull out of areas. It's not going to be like
that. Do you have a projected timeline?
Well, no, not yet. I mean, okay. We are also, of course, working with the donors in terms of getting a clearer picture as to what the funding is going to be like for 2024. And so on the basis of that, we will be able to have a timeline, have a clear view in terms of what our prioritization is going to be. I have one very concrete timeline, that is that if the national government does not step in And if we don't get new international donor funding, then I would say in 3 to 4 weeks' time, we will no longer be able to transport or to support the transportation of arrivals from Sudan in Rink or any other part of the country to their areas of destination. Now, that's a very concrete timeline.
3 to 4 weeks.
3 to 4 weeks. Yes, wow. That is really a serious concern, because if that happens, specifically, I'm worried about what is going to happen. Well, I'm worried about the returnees, but I'm certainly worried about what is going to happen in Rink, because we will not, if people have to stay in Rink, we don't have the money nor the capacity to provide basic humanitarian services in Rink. We just don't have it. So
let me ask, there's a substantial amount that has been received, about 45%.
Yes, correct.
How much more do you need to be able to sustain this aid that you're giving to the returnees?
Well, I mean, I think that ideally, of course, the humanitarian response plan would be fully funded. That's what we would be looking for. And I think that's not particularly realistic. But we should, if we were able to go up to 60 or 65% of that, I think that would help. I'm not particularly optimistic that we're going to see a huge increase of international funding. And it's not because the donors in South Sudan are unwilling, but it is simply that at the global scale, South Sudan is competing with a lot of other crises. There are a lot of other crises going on, both on the continent here in Africa, and of course, Ukraine, as we are all aware. The neighboring country, Sudan, is also in need of a lot of resources. So it's not that people don't want. But it's simply that the pie that is there needs to be divided across multiple crises. And of course, if I may also, the fact that South Sudan has been the recipient of very high levels of humanitarian assistance for many, many years also creates a certain sense in the capitals of the donor countries, saying like, well, but, you know, when is this going to end? When are we going to be able to reduce the humanitarian assistance to South Sudan? This should have been the case already. South Sudan should have been on a path, is what you hear in capital cities. We should have now been providing a lot less humanitarian, or there should have been a lot less people, put it like that. There should have been a lot less people in need of humanitarian assistance.
Yeah.
We're still looking at more than 75% of the population in South Sudan that requires humanitarian assistance.
And it's been like that for a long time.
And it's been like that for a long time. And it's actually going backwards rather than forwards when you look at, you know, the percentage of people in need are going up rather than down. So that creates this sentiment like, okay, well, are we going to continue throwing money at this? Or so that's why I think this issue of development is really absolutely critical, because it's either more development or more suffering. I mean, there's not going to be some sort of middle ground in that.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for laying this all for us to process and prepare. I would just ask briefly as we conclude, what is your hope? What do you want to see as a humanitarian? You've seen the experience, you've been on the ground, you know the potential for South Sudan. What is your hope? And in 5-10 years, what exactly do you want to see? How would you want to see South Sudan grow, reduce that number that you said, 75%? It's been there for a long time and it's going up. How can it go down as required?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the first hope would be a full peace in South Sudan, so that we've had stability in Juba, but that we, in 5 to 10 years' time, there will be no more talk about conflict in different parts of South Sudan. That's the first thing. Secondly, that you would be able to drive around South Sudan. There would be the roads would be there, and we would see communities that are busily doing their agriculture and other economic activities around the country. And thirdly, that we would be able to say that every child in South Sudan, boy, girl, poor or rich, has access to education and has the is provided with the environment where he or she can develop their full potential, talents and ambitions for life. And I think if we have those factors, I mean, I think it is possible to do. I think it is possible in South Sudan to do that. There are other countries where you think like, well, they have no resources. How are they ever going to be able to develop themselves? It's very complicated. But South Sudan has everything it needs, I think, to develop itself. So, and I hope that as a fourth point, that at that point in time when we have the International Humanitarian Day, that there will only be like a very few humanitarians left, and you won't even invite anyone to come and speak about humanitarian assistance to the radio, to be honest.
From your own perspective, your own thing, when do you feel South Sudan could possibly achieve this?
Well, I mean, okay, I think we have to also be realistic in the sense it's not going to happen next year. But yes. I think if you look at a time frame of a decade with focused attention, it is possible, I think, for South Sudan to, if there is the political will, if there is a focused attention, if there is a willingness of all the parties that are currently engaged in violence here and there to stop that, within a decade, I think a lot of strides can be made. I sometimes think about, if you think about, and this is a totally non-political statement, but if you look at, for example, a country like Rwanda that went through a genocide in 1994, where, you know, the country essentially was destroying itself. And you look in 10, 20, 30 years' time where that country has gotten to. I think it's an example of that. You show that it is possible, even, and they were in a much worse situation in 1994 than South Sudan is today. And so I think that is an example where you can see that this type of developmental progress is actually possible. So I think in 10 years' time, with the focused political attention, South Sudan could really be on a path of self-sufficiency and a massive reduction of poverty across the population. So 10 years' time, I think, would be a realistic time frame. With the right political will, I think it is possible.